But let's stay back to the nitty gritty here. And the real question that people want to get into, which is, what are we going to do now in terms of upfront therapy? And before we start to go through various scenarios, I want to hear a case from Katie. But before we get into that, Joyce, could you just summarize the two recent approvals that came out that now are causing everybody to really think deeply about what to do, so to speak?
Yeah, so quite hot off the press. So it's probably about, what, 3-4 weeks ago now, maybe less than that. Twice in COVID. That niraparib was approved off of the PRIMA data for women who had responded to frontline platinum-based chemotherapy. And so that was approved as single-agent maintenance across the board, regardless of biomarker, for women with advanced ovarian cancer. And then, you know, just last week, maybe, based off of PAOLA-1, the combination of bevacizumab and olaparib was approved for women, again, who had responded to frontline chemotherapy and who were considered HRD positive or genomically unstable by the Myriad MyChoice CDX. And so those were the two approvals that just came through.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the options that are available. I'm going to, a couple of you, and I think with Rob, I was trying to draw the analogy between your situation and ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. Call me crazy, but we'll get into that in a minute. Before you get into my whole theory of numeracy and trying to figure out what you all are actually doing and what the basis of it is so we can develop education programs. But Katie, let's talk about a case first before we start getting into these algorithms. And you have this 53-year-old woman. Can you talk about what happened to her?
Sure. So this is a 53-year-old presented in a very typical way with abdominal bloating and some changes in her bowel and bladder habits. She was seen by outside providers who gave her laxatives and other things that didn't help her, and finally presented to an OB-GYN who did a pelvic exam and appreciated a large mass and then did a transvaginal ultrasound with a big complex mass and ascites, and drew a CA125, which was markedly elevated. And so she was sent to see us, where we ordered a CT. So you can see some free fluid, omental caking on the left-hand side, and then this very complex, not friendly looking mass in the pelvis. So she underwent surgery, primary surgery. She was a young and healthy person. Found to have high-grade serous ovarian cancer. Like Dr. Liu, we sent both somatic and germline testing. So she was germline BRCA wild type, but she did have some interesting, kind of a typical next-gen sequencing panel, with the exception of the BRAF, which is a little weird in a high-grade serous. And then she had also the Myriad test sent, which showed an LOH score greater than 16. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is a foundation test, LOH score greater than 16. So a different test than Myriad.
So, Rob, what would you be thinking at this point before we hear what actually happened?
So she's, you know, we would classify this as a HR deficient, situation with her LOH score being greater than 16% on foundation medicine.
So what do you think you likely would do? Would you give her a PARP inhibitor? And if so, which one? Would you give her Bev?
So with that knowledge ahead of time, I would consider her for a PARP inhibitor.
Which one?
I think, if you're sticking with the label, niraparib would be the one that, would be approved unless we had started Bev. And then she would be eligible. Well, she wouldn't technically be eligible, but I would probably still advocate for the use of olaparib.
So, Katie, what actually happened?
So she didn't have really bulky disease, and so didn't meet sort of high risk features. And I didn't elect to put her on bevacizumab post-op. And she's BRCA wild type, and so went into complete response following every 21-day paclitaxel carboplatin, and we used niraparib.
Mm-hmm. What was her platelet count, her weight, and what dose of niraparib did you use?
We would base her starting dose based on baseline weight, which is greater than or less than 77 kilograms, or baseline platelets greater than or less than 150,000. So if either of those are present, low weight, low platelets, we'd start her at 200 milligrams a day. If neither is present, I would start her. And honestly, if she had no problems with chemo, I would start her at 300. I do think there's clinical judgment that goes into these things. So
definitely,
you know,
and we'll, Katie, I was going to say, Neil, one thing to add here is, and this is where we'll come up, talk about this when we get to the veliparib, but is when you start. So how much break do you give between chemo and starting your niraparib?
I wait at least 6 weeks. So I see them for that 3 week visit post cycle six and talk about PARP inhibitor options at that point. And I do a lot of counseling and then I tell them we don't need to start anything for at least 3 weeks. And then I see them back again and we get the authorization and they usually start maybe 7 or 8 weeks, just depends on when they get the PARP. So I try to have them on by 8 weeks, but I don't start like cycle seven.
Right away. Yeah,
that's exactly. A great question. Yeah. Next time we do one of these 25 people poll, we can even ask that. So how long has she been on treatment and how's she tolerating it?
She's tolerating it well. She hasn't been on very long. So fortunately, you know, the NCCN guidelines came out before the FDA approval. So so we just slid right in there. And so she's only been on, those came out in January. So she's only been on about 3 months. And it's actually doing quite well. You know, the first 2 months of PARP are the worst for patients. And I just flat out tell them that because you're going to have nausea very rapidly. And then you have to individualize the dosing by cycle three. So she's through that now. We have her on the right dose and hopefully we'll be kind of smooth sailing from here. But I find the first few months you have to do some intervention sometimes.
I just have a question for Katie, like for niraparib, are you doing the CBC weekly?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm very, if you ask any of my partners, I'm sort of a little rabid about that.
Dogmatic. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
You know, it kind of makes me crazy here because they, I have so much help here, but they do it on all the PARPs. So like all the PARPs are getting labs now. And I'm like, you don't have to do it for olaparib, but I actually don't care because I'd rather overtest there than miss niraparib 100% weekly until we're solid on the counts. And then I relax it to every 3 weeks. Well, and I do that for a few months, but I don't let them go too long.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the next case and maybe Stephanie, you can react to it. I'll just interject here. One of the other questions that came in was what about the status of using PARP inhibitors in other cancers? And just to pump out, we're actually doing a satellite to the AACR meeting on June 23rd. We'll send all the attendees a notification, but we're talking about breast, ovary, pancreas, and prostate.
There you go.
All four of them in that same meeting on the 23rd. Mm-hmm. So for those of you who are interested, and it's really great when you get everybody together and they start comparing notes about toxicity. It's super interesting.
That was fascinating last year. I learned so much about pancreas last year. It was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, Katie was part of that.
Even talking about HRD between the difference between the different types, the definition of HRD is so conflictual between the
Exactly. Anyhow, it's different.
Well, you know, the prostate people are saying it should be called PRCA and not BRCA because prostate is so BRCA-like. But anyhow, Katie, what about this 63-year-old lady? She had a lot of disease there when she presented.
Yeah, so this is a little different situation. She's a little bit older, underwent surgery, unfortunately, on the outside and had really extensive disease and so got to us with a lot of disease and an incision on her belly and a pleural effusion. So, you know, we had to get her just going on therapy. So she was high-grade endometrioid on pathology review at our site, and you can see her next-gen sequencing panel that we sent. I don't know why I picked two people with BRAF, but here you go.
That's so weird.
It's so weird. I didn't do it on purpose. I didn't have a point.
Incidentally, are those V600E BRAFs?
No.
Oh, okay. No. Okay.
Yes. All right. Well, anyhow. I don't know that they're actionable, to be honest. Yeah.
Right.
LOH here was less than 16%, but an ARID1 mutation, which is somewhat interesting as well.
Yeah.
So she got paclitaxel carboplatin every 21 days with bevacizumab here. Because of her stage 4A status, she responded with her CA125, but not great. You know, still elevated at 400, had a partial response at the end of 6 cycles. And she really did not tolerate the bevacizumab well, having to come off with very, very high blood pressures despite aggressive management. But I'd already planned on using the Paola regimen when I stopped the bevacizumab, so I'd already gotten it authorized again because the NCCN guidelines came out in January. And so I just rolled with the olaparib. That's what I did.
So this relates to the Bev hypertension. Did you dose reduce her?
With the Bev?
Yeah.
We did it because
I've done that.
Have you done that? Does it work?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, you know that you know you have a broad therapeutic window there. It does work, actually.
So cool. Anyhow,